There's the point of launch. I think the most impressive thing about a launch is that at that point in time, there's 6.5 million pounds of thrust under you and 4.5 million pounds of dead weight. And anyone who can do mathematics can figure out F equals MA and so on and so forth. The first thing you realize is that 4.5 million pounds of dead weight takes off extremely slowly. You can't get that amount of mass moving fast. And contrary to popular belief, when you take off, you can look out the window and the launch tower drifts slowly by. But then with all that thrust under you, it's amazing how fast you go in a short period of time. For example, jettison your solid rocket booster, candles on each side, at about 2 minutes and 13 seconds after T0, and then you jettison the main fuel tank at about 8.5 minutes after T0. So that's basically within 9 minutes you're on orbit. So you go from 0 miles per hour in the Great American System to 17,500 miles an hour in a little over 8.5 minutes. I can assure you, you're moving at that point. There we are. As I say, we launched on the point of dawn. This photograph's obviously looking east. Very unique in one situation. We've just punched through a cloud deck. Very unusual circumstance to be able to get permission to do that, because for safety reasons, if something goes wrong at launch, there's a recovery landing strip fairly about a mile away from the pad, and you need to be able to visualize that, you know, and something goes wrong to be able to visualize that and come back. The way we were allowed to do it is that it was a very peculiar cloud bank, insofar as although we launched through the clouds, with the clouds had a very sharp demarcation line, the view of the recovery landing site was in fact clear. But once you get on orbit, I can assure you the most spectacular thing, the thing you'll never forget, far more exciting than the launch, far more exciting than the landing, is the view. And this slide is very typical of what you see when you first get on orbit. Which, by the way, it is not upside down. This is typically your first view of the Earth from space. Because typically the shuttle orbits in what they call a minus ZLV local vertical, which is minus Z-axis down local vertical. So it's inverted and flipped. So you're going tail forward, invert. That's a minus ZLV local vertical configuration. But when you're there standing up, looking out the window, the Earth is above you in a minus ZLV. Think about that. And that's what you see. The spectacular part about it is that it's a three-dimensional view. All the films, all the slides, all the photographs you've seen are two-dimensional. When you first look at the Earth from space, it immediately becomes apparent it's three-dimensional. And so it's a blue and white ball. The other thing that hits you, that blue and white ball is surrounded by the infinity and the blackness of space, and it jumps out at you. And what that means is you've got this black panorama with a blue and white ball. The effect on your brain is it looks like that blue and white ball is very close to you. It's not, obviously, but it is, because it's surrounded by this blackness and the infinity of space, and it's that contrast that makes the Earth jump out of you, out at you. Just to make the point one more time that in zero gravity there's no such thing as up. The advantage of that turns out to be that, for example, you say, how do, say, seven people go to space in the orbiter? aren't you all crowded? The answer is yes, you are, but just like in this room, half the volume of this room is never used. It's that half, because you never ever see anyone walking on the ceiling. In zero gravity, it is just as easy to walk on the ceiling as it is on the floor. Therefore, you can use the whole volume of the orbiter, and therefore you've got twice as much space as you think you have. So if you operate in this mode, it's actually not nearly as crowded as you think. One of the effects of zero gravity, obviously, is that your cardiovascular system reacts differently. It's been trained for millions of years for the blood to run downhill and the heart to pump it back up. If there's no hill for it to run down, the heart says, this is easy, and it basically stops functioning. You know, it still keeps going, but it slows down. That's really not good for your body not to circulate blood. So the way you get around that is you exercise. If you keep exercising, the heart says, okay, I've got to pump more blood, and so on and so forth. Except it's a little difficult to exercise, because if you get on a treadmill, after the first two steps, you're over the other side of the room because you're floating around. So what you do is you wear this harness which goes over you. It's got big bungee cords at the back. And then you run like hell, like trained mice, until your pulse rate comes up, and then you get the blood circulating. You usually do that about twice a day. You have to do it on a very regular basis just to keep things turning around the right way. I thought I'd show you a few views from space just to get you a feel for what things look like. Of course, the hardest thing to do is to start to figure out the scale of something you're looking at from space, because the scale is totally different from what you're used to. You're not used to looking at things at that distance away. And I've carefully chosen these slides to give you different looks at the Earth, a different sort of features, so you can get an idea of the scale. Does anyone have any idea what they're looking at there? It's a city right in the centre of that. A city stand out, you can look out the window, see a city. They tend to be very grey in colour. If you look very carefully though, you can see things like rivers and bridges over rivers and things like that. Just to give you an idea, the river here is the Potomac River. This is the city of Washington, D.C. Right there is the Capitol building. See that there? This is Andrews Air Force Base here. Give you an idea. This is Dulles International Airport here. This is the 14th Street Bridge here. And there's a circle right there. See that circle with a hole in it? That's the RFK Sports Stadium in Washington. You can see that amount of detail very easily with the unaided eye from low Earth orbit from the shuttle. You can see that amount of detail. We all know what we're looking at here. This is Long Island of New York. Does anyone know how long Island is? Thank you. It's about 100 miles from tip to tip, to give you an idea. It comes up here to Massachusetts, Cape Cod. The Kennedy compound is just in there. You've heard about that. There's a far more important reason. New York City is in here. There's the Hudson River. New York is all in here. Kennedy Airport is hard to see on this, but it's down in there. But more importantly, if you come up to the tip of Long Island, then you've got the Connecticut River there. You've got the Mystic River there. If you've got extremely good eyesight, there's a little bridge, and just there is where... Yeah, well, you've got to learn to interpret this, and just there is my house. That's why I took the photograph. Very obvious to me, and the grass needs mowing as well. Got to learn to interpret this. Okay, what are we looking at there? Anyone got any idea? Huh? Nile Delta. Exactly right. That's very quick. This is the Nile River here. Okay. Alexandria is up here. This is desert here. Mediterranean here. Shuttle here. Vertical stabilizer. The pyramids. I'm not sure you can see the pyramids on this. Series of shots which are all connected. I rather like this shot because what you're looking at here is the whole of the Mediterranean. Strait of Gibraltar, Gibraltar's in here. Gulf of Cadiz, Portugal, Morocco. Why I like this photograph is it shows you in one photograph the whole of the ancient world. And the point is all of civilization basically started in this very small part of the earth. There it is in one photograph. As I say, I've got about three or four slides that are all connected. We've taken the high oblique view as we're coming up over the Mediterranean. Now we're getting a lot closer. Gulf of Cadiz, Gibraltar, Strait of Gibraltar, we're getting a lot closer. Morocco. Notice that in the water here there's some circular lines. Does anyone know what that is? Yes. Who was that? Exactly right. That's the tide. You've got the Atlantic Ocean out here. The tide's going up and down, trying to force a great mass of water through this narrow strait of Gibraltar. The monkeys are sitting right there on the rock. And this is a tidal pulse, which is a series of non-linear waves, it turns out. There's usually about seven in the series. They've got a very distinct structure. The leading edge is the strongest, and there's an exponential decay in the wave packet, but it's a tidal pulse going through the Strait of Gibraltar. We're now directly overhead. We're looking directly vertically. Morocco again, the tip of Gibraltar up there, and you can see this tidal pulse. This is all cloud here. This is sort of white puffball cumulus cloud.
How high is that like?
Ah, good question. Good question. It's amazing what you can see from space. The actual amplitude of that wave is about 3 to 4 centimeters.
Why such a shading effect then?
Why the shading effect? Because we use the natural enhancement of the sun glitter pattern. We look at the reflection of the sun in the water. If you've done any flying in an aircraft over water, it's called, you look at the specular point or the reflection point, and it tends to enhance any subtle changes in the texture. So you're looking from at space at a feature that's 3 to 4 centimeters in amplitude, and you can see it very easily. Very interesting. And this is, again, we've now orbited, we're still on the same orbit. We've come in from the Gulf of Cadiz, we've flown over the Strait of Gibraltar. Here's Gibraltar in here, the rocks there, you can see the monkeys. We're orbiting over this way, we're now looking back. One tidal pulse before that. Tidal pulse before that. Point being there is the ocean is not random. The ocean does have a memory and it is all coherent. You can see three tidal pulses of information, if you will. Three sets of waves. Waves are information. Way we communicate with waves. We just happen to be acoustic waves. These are oceanographic waves or fluid waves. Nevertheless, that's information in those waves. Another thing you can see, that's the end of that series. This turns out to be also in the Mediterranean. I'm showing you this just to give you an idea of the sort of things you can see. You go over the water, you think, oh, it's blue water. No, you can see a lot. We're looking, again, in the specular point of the sun's reflection. We've carefully taken the photograph in that specular point. I've blown it up, so we're looking at a dimension here of about 50 kilometers on a side. 50 kilometers. Each one of these bright lines is in fact a shear line. The ocean is in fact shearing on itself. So if you start counting the lines, these shear lines are less than a kilometre apart. To give you an idea how much energy is, this is the wake of a ship going across the Mediterranean. You can see when it gets to the big shear lines, the wakes get sheared. There's another ship and a ship's wake here. And what this is the energy is, in all these shears, it's energy. Energy in nature tends to arrange itself. It arranges itself in shears. You can duplicate this in fluid tanks in the laboratory. But when it gets energetic enough, these shears, which are like rubber bands, roll themselves up into balls, and so you can in fact get spiral eddies out of them. See these spiral eddies forming? All good hydrodynamics. And when they get energetic enough, even the spiral eddies align themselves in streets called vortex streets. Here they are. See them? There's a fourth one there. Here's the shear lines. Again, this is we're seeing in the ocean some hydrodynamic features that people had only theorized, but we're able to in fact see them from space with the naked eye. Just to show it's not just the Mediterranean, this is a couple of photographs off New York. You can just start to see the landmass here. New York's in here. This is all cloud up here, cloud here, but you can see something in the water here. When you get a little closer and you get it in the specular point of the sun, here it is again. See those features? It looks very similar. And you say, yeah, but they're a different size. And I'm going to say, no, fooled you, because I took them with a different camera, with a different lens, a different focal length. And if you blow this photograph up to compensate for the different focal length lens, you find out that they're exactly the same features in the Mediterranean with exactly the same scale lengths, because nature has a way of being organized, and so you don't see one thing happening at one scale and a very similar thing happening at a totally different scale. Nature tends to get organized. A couple of other things that jump out at you from space is that rivers are very obvious. Most rivers actually carry a lot of sediment from the riverbed into the ocean, and it comes out into the ocean quite a way, so you're looking at a distance of several kilometres out here. Does anyone know where you're looking at, whereabouts in the world you are?
New Orleans.
What's that?
New Orleans.
No, that's a good guess. It's not. I'll give you a clue. If you go take a ship up there and go up through that passageway, you'll find the city of Venice. And that's the Po and the Po River Delta in Italy. Other dramatic thing is, this is a brilliant picture of Iran. Iran has a lot of sand. Remember the hostage mission with the US some years ago when they flew the helicopters in and it was a disaster? The reason is that what they forgot is that deserts tend to have these sandstorms. Here's a sandstorm off Iran. You can just about see where the coastline is up through there. This is a sandstorm off the desert, and so you're looking at, in this scale, at least 50 kilometres of sand suspended in the atmosphere being blown off the desert. Very dramatic from space. One of the things we did was to launch a satellite. There's several ways of launching a satellite. Really, the easiest one is to take it out of the cargo bay on the RMS, remote manipulated system, the robot arm on the shuttle. You just pluck it out with that. You hold it out there. You unfold the Mickey Mouse ears, which are really solar panels for power up the satellite. And in this way, you can check it out. You're still holding on to it. You can get electrical communications with the satellite. You can check out the systems. And then when you're happy with it, all you have to do to launch that satellite is disengage the arm, and then the shuttle is in orbit. The satellite is in orbit right alongside you. Again, you can check out its communication systems. If everything's all right, you fire these little jet thrusters, you see one there, and you can push it up to a higher orbit. If something at that point, before you do the jet thrusters, of course, doesn't check out, you just put the arm, you re-engage the arm, put it back on the shuttle and bring it back to Earth, and you haven't lost a satellite. So it's probably the safest way to launch a satellite. One of the things that we did, it's never been done before, it was a little risky actually, was that we tried out for the first time, could you refuel a satellite in space? Say, refuel a satellite? Yes. The communication satellites, for example, have fuel on board. The fuel is not to keep them up there, but because they tend to wander around a little bit, say they're in geosynchronous orbit, then you have to have extremely small jet thrusters to sort of re-establish its configuration so it can point directly to the point on Earth that it needs to for communications. Well, after a few years, they run out of fuel. So rather than put up a new satellite, the thought was to sort of bring them down to low Earth orbit, bring them on board, refuel, and put them back up. The problem with that is that the fuel that they use is a very unusual fluid. And at that point in time when we flew, no one had ever really confidently calculated how that chemical composition of the fuel would react to zero gravity. Problem with this sort of fuel is it can explode. So I can assure you we did this operation extremely carefully. We had two people, Dave Leitzmer and Kathy Sullivan, who actually put on spacesuits, went out there and actually went through a whole refueling operation. You can start to see some of that there. There's Dave Leitzmer during the refueling operation. The point to note, of course, is you've got to have a full spacesuit outside the orbiter. There is no atmosphere in space. If there's no atmosphere, there's no pressure. If there's no pressure, you're in a vacuum. If you're in a vacuum, your blood will boil in well less than a second, and I can assure you that will spoil the rest of your day. One thing you've got to notice is you take tools up there, just like down here on Earth. The problem with your little handy-dandy toolkit is you've got to be very careful, because you open your toolkit and all the tools float away. Very difficult. So you do a very simple thing. You tie them all down on little strings like dogs on a leash. Trouble is, when they float around, you know what's going to happen? All the leashes get tied up. So working in space, especially in a zero gravity outside the orbiter, is very difficult. You have to do it very slowly, very carefully, very methodically, otherwise you get into trouble. One of the little concerns we had, we were due to land back at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. This was only the second time that had been attempted. The landing strip in Florida is extremely short. The problem why it wasn't used for quite a number of flights is with a short runway, they had problems with the brakes. If you've got problems with the brakes on a short runway, you've probably got a big problem. But when we did it, we were only the second shuttle ever to land back at Kennedy. The problem that we noticed, this photograph was taken a day before we were due to land. If you look carefully, that's the hurricane. It's Hurricane Josephine. And if you look even very more carefully, right about there is the Kennedy Space Center where we were supposed to land. So we figured we had a problem. Interesting about hurricanes though, from on orbit you can fly, if you get it exactly right, fly over a hurricane, look down the eye of a hurricane, and you can literally see the waves of the ocean. It's perfectly clear through the eye. I was quite surprised to see that. Well, fortunately the wind came up and moved the hurricane out to sea. We were given permission to land. So this is the same area taken one orbit before we land, one orbit being 90 minutes. You go around the Earth 90 minutes, which means you go through a day-night cycle in 90 minutes, which it means you have 45 minutes of daylight followed by 45 minutes of nighttime. This is pad 39A, 39B. This is pad 39A from which we launch from. And here's the here's the landing strip. Keep in mind that landing strip is still relatively, as I say, relatively short. You start your approach at 17,500 miles an hour. You have no engines, it's a dead stick landing, dead stick approach. You can only get one shot at it. So there's a few things you have to watch on landing. This is the last sunrise that we saw on orbit. As I say, in a 90 minute orbit, you go through a sunrise and a sunset sequence every 45 minutes. They're all very beautiful. They all look like this. You'll notice, for example, the layering of the atmosphere. You will also notice how thin the atmosphere is compared to the thickness of the Earth. Don't forget, we human beings live on a planet that has an extremely small, narrow film of atmosphere around it, which is what, you know, preserves our life. So this is what, you know, this environmentalism is really all about. It's preserving that thin skin of life-preserving atmosphere around our planet. As you do a deorbit burn to start your approach, as soon as that orbiter starts to go into the atmosphere, even the very thin atmosphere at high altitudes, you're hitting it at a tremendous speed. It generates a lot of heat. That's why you need the tiles, especially the black tiles on the underbelly of the orbiter, so that you don't burn yourself up. It hits the atmosphere at such speed that it literally pulls apart the molecules of the atmosphere. When you pull particles apart at that sort of rate, you form charged ionized gas called a plasma, which you've probably heard about. That plasma glows. It's an orange glow. It's a pulsating orange glow. And so when you start your approach, you look out the cockpit window. This is Bob Crippen. I'm looking over his shoulder taking this photograph, and all you can see is this pulsating orange glow. The difficulty with that is, in a plasma being a charged particle, it will not admit radio energy. A plasma stops transmission of radio energy, and therefore we can't, at this stage, we can't communicate back to mission control. And for about 15, it takes you about 30 minutes from a deorbit burn to a landing. And so for about the first 15 minutes of that 30 minutes, it's what's called the blackout period. It's got nothing to do with us on the orbiter. It's got everything to do with communications. We are blacked out from communications purely and simply because of this plasma that we're generating on re-entry. So you go through all that. Actually, the approach is pretty benign. Of course, we'd practiced many times in the STAs, or shuttle training aircraft, which are configured to fly like the shuttle. It's a fairly benign approach, except that a jet airliner landing at Kingston Smith Airport in Sydney has a glide path, or the angle of approach, of about between 2 and 3 degrees. The glide path of the shuttle is 19 degrees. You're doing that very fast. The Earth comes up dramatically, so you do a tremendous flare before you crash. And just after you do the flare, you put your wheels down. And that's what, by the way, why you don't put your wheels down to the last minute, because you've got to go through the flare maneuver before you put your wheels down. But nevertheless, it's still pretty benign. It's very smooth. You get a bit of wing tip vibration as you come back through the sound barrier, but that's about the only vibration you get in terms of flight approach. Here we are, as I say, coming back at the Kennedy landing strip. This is the bayous or rivers, whatever they call them there. And here we are touching down. You can see the puffs of smoke, just like a commercial airliner. I can assure you, you wait for that sort of thumping down of the main wheels, because at that point in time, you figure once you get your wheels down, that if anything goes wrong now, at least you can probably handle it. Before that, you really had your doubts. But it's sort of a, you know, coming, glad to be home, that sort of feeling that you get as soon as those wheels touch down. I like showing this slide because See, with the shuttle, it's a far more civilized. And so this was a one of the early shuttle flights, but nevertheless, it was a big advance over the Apollo days, because in the Apollo days, you'd have to get in a capsule, you'd have to land in the ocean with parachutes, and you'd have to hope like hell the Navy found you before you sank. This is far more civilized. You land on solid earth, very much like you do at any other airport. You come down the steps, and this is us egressing after 8.5 days in space, and we're egressing about 30 minutes after touchdown. Far more civilized way. Don't even have to learn to swim. And so I just want to leave you with one thought at the end of this, that if you think that you may have been standing on your head during this lecture, floating around in zero gravity, the final thought is, there's only one way to fly. Thank you very much.